start a four-week program, though there's a month break coming up for you, on the second part of the creed. We've done, I believe in God the Father, Almighty, Creator of heaven and earth. Now we move to, I believe in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord, and we go right through the born of the Virgin Mary and so on, right through to the life of Jesus. Now, that covers 260 articles in your catechism, and I'm covering that whole area, but I'm not covering it in the pattern in the same order as the catechism does. What I'm doing actually is I did give a whole series of lectures on who is Jesus, actually 20 years ago, and they were recorded by the Daughters of St. Paul. They're all on tape. I've got them on the back table for you to look at. I've actually put the tapes onto CD, so they're all available too, should it interest anybody. And that's the order I'm following. But the book itself is out of print, so it's not available, but I'm just except in a library perhaps. So I'm following the order that I followed for that, because I did a lot of work into it, and I think it's the best order that I'm aware of. What I'm covering in this section then is, in part one, which is today, I'm talking about Jesus of Nazareth. In other words, I'm going through the whole of the New Testament, and this is not easy to do, and I wouldn't be certain I've done it absolutely rightly, but I've put a lot of work into it, and try to discern from it what the writers of the New Testament and the disciples of Jesus thought of Jesus, understood him to be up to and including his crucifixion. In other words, the Jesus that walked among them, how did they see him then as they walked with him? What did they come to think about him? How did they come to understand him within the limits of that time frame they had with him prior to the resurrection? Okay? That's our topic today. And I'll be presenting to you what actually I've covered in 14 lectures in that lecture series, and I'm doing it in one. So it'll just be, it'll all be familiar to you, but I want you to get a kind of a sweeping view of Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Mary, the friend of Simon and Judas and Nathanael and so on, that person. When we come back after the break, I've got three other things to do with you. One is to look, which is quite a different view, how did the early church community come to think of the risen Christ? So in light of the resurrection and their post-crucifixion experiences, obviously they came to insights about Jesus they didn't have prior to that. So what were they? How did they look at the risen Christ? How do they speak about him in the New Testament? Paul and John and the rest of them. My third step, part three, was, and this is what you do before you do the kind of teasing out that I've attempted to do. What you've got in the Gospels is Jesus of Nazareth, the story of his life, basically from the baptism to the crucifixion, two and a half, three-year period only. But when they describe Jesus of Nazareth, they talk about him and present him in portraits that are seen to be significant, symbolically significant for the whole community, because you have to select. Every biographer selects the significant things that are relevant to the community for whom they're writing. So what you've got in the New Testament is Jesus of Nazareth presented by people who have experienced the risen Christ, lived with their thoughts about the risen Christ for 30 years, and are in the light of that reflection, they look back at Jesus and see him in the glow of the resurrection, which you always have. The way we look back at people, and in the light of experience, we look back and think, oh, that's what Dad was on about, or that's what Mum was on about, or that's what my wife was trying to tell me 30 years ago, or do you know what I mean? Experience teaches us. So the Gospels are written in the 30 years after Jesus' death, and that's a lot of experience. So when they write it with a view that they didn't have necessarily when they were walking around with Jesus around Galilee. You're still with me? So that's the third thing to do. The fourth thing to do, and I think it'd be very wise if none of you came to the fourth lecture, because the fourth lecture is taking you through 300 years of the early church history. I've done it over in those tapes and CDs in about four goes, but you're going to get it in one. And it's blockbuster theology. Like, it has to be done, because it leads up to the Nicene Creed, which we're talking about, the Creed. So it's an interesting journey for you, I would imagine. But if you've got a headache, don't come. If you're feeling a bit don't come. And if I've got a sore throat, I'll still be here. All right? So that's a dogmatic view of the development of church teaching for the up till the year 451, and after that it's pretty settled. So let's begin. Hence all those colours. What we're doing today is part one, and that covers those numbers in the catechism and those numbers in the catechism and those numbers in the and those. You got it? And those. So the catechism, in my view, is all mixed up. They might say I'm all mixed up, but I mean it doesn't make the kind of distinctions that I want to make with you. Hence I'm not able to follow it straight through, but have to double back all the time. Let's begin. Jesus of Nazareth, that's your focus. The Jesus that walked around, smelt the flowers, held little babies, talked to people, emptied the temple, and finally died on the cross. That's our topic. He was born just prior to the death of Herod the Great. That's following Matthew's gospel, which is not biographical, but probably is in touch with that. They would have had met. So it seems from that Jesus was born before the death of Herod the Great. Herod the Great, we know now, working out the thing, died in 4 BC. Well, the fact that Jesus was born before 4 BC may come as a slight surprise to you, because BC means before Christ, and AD means Anno Domini, or after the year of the Lord. All that means is that the 6th century German monk, who did a marvellous job, because there was no world dating in the 6th century, everyone was dated according to the pharaoh here, or the emperor there, or the reign of somebody here, or whatever, all separate dating. He pulled it all together and estimated within about 4 or 5 years, which was a remarkable thing since he didn't have a library available, when Jesus would have been born in the light of emperor this and pharaoh this and king this and someone else that. So he worked it out, and he made a mistake, that's all we can say. So that actually BC is a bit wonky. It's 4 or 5 years out, if you want to be accurate, in the light of what we now know. So Jesus then died by crucifixion when Pontius Pilate was military prefect in Judea. He wasn't actually, he was a military prefect. Let's stick to the simple part of it. And because the scholars suggest that John is actually not only the most symbolic gospel, but the most accurate when it comes to linking things with historical data, and that's quite a good thing to be aware of, John, you'll know, has Jesus dying on the eve of the Passover, and the Passover in John's Gospel is a Sabbath, a Saturday. Whereas, in the Synoptic Gospels, Jesus dies on the feast of the Passover, which is a Friday. So you can't pull them together and work it all out. There are theories about it, none of which, in my view, add up. So what the Synoptic Gospels are doing is Jesus died on the occasion of the Passover. And so they tell their story with all those lovely symbols, as you would if your father died on December the 24th at Christmas time. Well, you're not going to be bothered 40 years later in getting all the details. You want to bring all the Christmas symbols into the situation, even though he died just before it. Okay. Assuming that John is more accurate than the synoptics in his dating of it, then scholars have worked out that the Passover was on a Sabbath, a Saturday, in the year 30 and again in the year 33. And they are the only two possible dates. Hence, we can conclude, with a bit of iffiness in it, but it's the probabilities all point to Jesus dying in either 30 AD or 33 AD. which means he died when he was 33 is the more usual date given. That's all I can say about that. If he died in 33, he was 37 or 38. If he died in 30, he was 35 or 34 or 36. So in his middle 30s, Jesus died. The main information that we have is from the Christian New Testament, which the earliest document in the Christian New Testament, I suggest to you, though I can't prove it, is probably 48 AD, which is only 15 years after the death of Jesus, and it's the letter to the Galatians of Paul. That's my opinion, which can be well argued, but it's not the normal opinion. Most people suggest the earliest document is 1 Thessalonians, which is in the year 50. So there's still a debate going on among scholars. And 100 is a good cut-off date for the New Testament. So it's 48 to 100. It's the last half of the first century is when the New Testament was written. And that's our main source. But we do have other sources. And I'll give you cut it down to the Josephus. About the year 93 AD, in his Antiquities, chapter 20, I won't give you the references now, 9:1, has in there, talks about James, the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ. He doesn't actually tell us about Jesus himself, but he talks about this famous figure, James, who was the leader of the Christian community in Jerusalem and was murdered, you'd have to say, by the Jewish high priest and his followers in that interregnum period when Rome, who had the military prefect, Pilate is one of them, was withdrawn in 40, and for four years, I think it was, it was self-governing in a way. Herod, one of the Herods, millions of Herods, but one of the Herods was governing it under Rome, but independently, and that gave the high priests and the Jewish leaders the opportunity, free from Roman control, to actually kill the leading Christian in Jerusalem, who's James. And that's the story told by Josephus, but he calls James the brother of Jesus. Brother, very vague term in their terms, but brother, in other words, a male in the same family as Jesus. Pliny the Younger, technically, was the governor of Bithynia. Now, Bithynia is just under the Black Sea, so northern Turkey. And he wrote a letter to the Emperor Trajan about 110 AD. So we're still, like, at the end of the New Testament period. We're quite early. And in that letter, this is what he wrote. I considered that I should dismiss any who denied that they were or had ever been Christians when they had repeated after me a formula of invocation to the gods and had made offerings of wine and incense to your statue. See, the problem was Christians were being outed, often by Jews, by the way, because they weren't. Christians were considered atheists by their contemporaries because they didn't worship their gods. And the gods, and therefore if there was any trouble anywhere, like a famine, like some disease went through them, or a failure in a war, well, they hadn't. Who are they going to blame? They're going to blame this little group of people who refused to worship the god of Mars or whatever, or didn't worship the emperor. So it's pagan, it's superstitious. But the Christians really were, and the Jews were free from all that by edict. So they had a kind of freedom, mainly because they saved Julius Caesar's life back in, I think it was 44 BC somewhere, down in Alexandria somewhere. So Julius Caesar gave the Jews a very special protection under the law. They didn't have to be in the military and they didn't have to worship their gods and all that. But the Christians had no such protection. So Pliny had the responsibility of persecuting Christians. But he was kind of a good man, and he was writing to the emperor trying to think, well, look, if I get them, even though they've been outed as Christians, if they actually end up worshipping the gods, which means they've given in their faith rather than face death, then he hasn't seen any good he doesn't want to persecute them, and he's wondering, should I do it? Should I still kill them even though they've given up their faith? And he continues, furthermore, had reviled the name of Christ. If I could get them to blaspheme against Christ, should I still kill them or should I forgive them or let them back? And then he goes on, more than this, but they meet regularly before dawn on a fixed day to chant verses alternately among themselves. You know, Kyrie eleison, Kyrie eleison, you know, an antiphonal singing in their rituals, in honour of Christ as if to a god. Now, that's Trajan's view, of course, but they chanted just like the Roman or other groups of religious people chanted when they were chanting to gods. So it's not any statement of faith here, but it's talking about Christ, clearly. Tacitus, the Roman historian, and there's a bit of bad luck here, and hopefully this would be more worth finding than the Gospel of Judas. He wrote an annals, a whole history of the Roman people, and it's good. He wrote it about 115 AD. Unfortunately, we haven't got books 7 to 10, and books 7 to 10 cover the history of Judea under Tiberius and Caligula, the exact period we would like to have his history. So if someone finds that, then we're really onto something. It's worth examining, but we haven't got it. So we can't argue from silence, but it would have been a good source, surely, for some information about Pontius Pilate and so on. But this is what he does have. In book 15, he talks about Nero. To suppress the rumour, and the rumour is that Nero had set fire to Rome, all the people thought that they hated Nero, and the emperor after Nero, by the way, Nero built this great Domus Aurea, the golden house, you know, where the ordinary poor were. He allowed the city to burn anyhow, even if he didn't, and he probably encouraged it, and about a third of the whole city was burnt, and the whole area that was burnt out by a fire, they often had fires in Rome, he then took for himself and built his great castle on it, in the place where now they've got the Colosseum. And there was a big statue to himself in gold, a colossal statue, hence the Colossus, hence we call it the Colosseum. So that was all Nero. The next emperor came, flattened the whole thing, built a park, and built the Colosseum for the enjoyment, if that's the word, of the populace. So they gave the land back to the people. Nero was hated. Anyhow, Nero was blamed by the people, for obvious reasons, because the fire suited him quite nicely. Now, to suppress the rumour, says Tacitus, the Roman historian, Nero fabricated scapegoats and punished with every refinement the notoriously depraved Christians, as they were popularly called. Notoriously depraved? I've given you the reasons. They never came to the church. They never worshipped the gods. They kept to themselves. And rumours were getting round that they used to eat the flesh and drink blood, you know. It's all pretty iffy stuff. So, their originator, Christ, had been executed in Tiberius's reign by the governor of Judea, Pontius Pilate. He would have told us a lot more about that, I think, in the books that we've lost. But in spite of this temporary setback, the deadly superstition had broken out afresh, not only in Judea, where the mischief had started, so he's no lover of Christianity, but even in Rome. Dressed in wild animal skins, they were torn to pieces by dogs or crucified and made into torches to be ignited after dark. Despite their guilt as Christians, the victims were pitied, for it was felt that they were being sacrificed to one man's brutality rather than to the national interest, says this Tacitus. Another historian, Suetonius, writing a little later, 125 to 130, in his Life of Claudius, the emperor, writes, because the Jews at Rome caused continuous disturbance at the instigation of Crestus, he, that's Claudius, expelled them from the city. If you know the Acts of the Apostles, when Paul first goes to Corinth, he meets Priscilla and her husband Aquila, who were expelled from Rome at the time of the whatever. So, and this helps us date a heck of a lot. A later historian dated this expelling from Rome, and it ends up being something like 49 AD. It helps us locate the timing of Paul's life is quite able to be pinned down either way from the year 49-50. Because Gallio, the brother of Seneca, was governor in Corinth for less than 1 year. It was a year's appointment, but his health wasn't good, and he pulled out, we know that from history, when the spring came and the sea was open for shipping again. So, and we know from the Acts of the Apostles that Gallio was there when Paul was there. So that's a bit of a distraction from our point. But in, at that time in Greek, Greek gets pronounced differently, Krestos, it would be properly pronounced Krestos, I would think. It's got a long E. And Christos, which is the name of Jesus, meaning the anointed one, were pronounced identically. In fact, today in Greek, half a dozen vowels are all pronounced E. Irene is peace, for example. Whereas in classical Greek, it would be Irene, but Irene. So they've simplified the language as we have with English. So at this time, we know that the long E and the I were pronounced identically. So anyone who heard the word Christos and didn't know anything about Messiah or Jewish thing would hear Christos, would write Christos. So we're no doubt talking about Christ. His life of Nero, he writes, punishments were inflicted on the Christians, a sect professing a new and mischievous religious belief. Now, that's not a lot of material, but it's there. No one you couldn't be so stupid as to deny the existence of Jesus. There's more evidence of the existence of Jesus than there is of Julius Caesar or any of these other characters around. But most of it is from the New Testament, and obviously from the disciples of this person who don't need arguing that. Let's look now at the New Testament. Jesus of Nazareth. I want you to watch here. Shouldn't have to stress it, but Jesus was a man. Is that all right? I mean, he wasn't a woman, but he was a human being who was a man. And here, look at all these texts. Just to give them to you, I'll read them without comment. Acts chapter 2. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with deeds of power, wonders, and signs that God did through him among you. God did through him among you. As you yourselves know, you crucified this man, but God raised him up. That's Paul's speech at Peter's speech at Pentecost. Very clearly, we're dealing with God, and we're dealing with Jesus, who's a man, and God's God, and God works through Jesus. Is that all right? 1 Corinthians 15. You as the Jewish crowd, the people that he's addressing in general, yeah. 1 Corinthians 15. The first man, brackets Adam, was from the earth, a man of dust. The second man is from heaven. Second man, Jesus. 2 Corinthians 5. In Christ, God was reconciling the world to himself. In the Messiah, you could always put Messiah where you read Christ. The Greek is Christos, but it comes from the Latin Messiah. So, in the Messiah, brackets Jesus, God was reconciling the world to himself. Romans 5:15, the grace of God and the free gift in the grace of the one man, Jesus Christ, abounded for the many. Not just for a little sect, not for a tiny group, but for the many. And Vatican II writes, and this is quoted in number 470 of the Catechism, Vatican II, Gaudium et Spes, the Son of God worked with human hands. He thought with a human mind. He acted with a human will. He loved with a human heart. Born of the Virgin Mary, he has truly been made one of us, like to us in all things. Except sin. Gaudium et Spes, 22, paragraph 2. Jesus' love, let's move to. So Jesus was a man, and love is the thing that most impressed people about this lovely son of Mary, Galilean Jesus, the carpenter. I'm actually quoting myself here, which sounds a bit silly. Not quite, but if I'm referring to my book, because I wrote it, I guess, so makes it easy for me to present it. What impressed people most about Jesus' love was that they experienced Jesus' love as God's love. They made that connection, which we do with each other too, of course. It's not unique to Jesus, but there was quite special in him. When he loved them, they felt loved by God. They say that. They felt it. They experienced it. They came to see Jesus not simply as a very loving man, but as one who opened them to God and revealed God to them. This is how his loving is portrayed in the Gospels. Something about their experience of Jesus brought them in touch with their own religious experience. He tapped into that deep experience of God or religious experience that they had. In loving people, Jesus was inviting them to share in his own religious love. When they loved him, he drew them, "I'm the way," he said, "to God." Speaking of the nourishment provided by Jesus' word and revelation, John has Jesus say in his drama, gospel, "As I, who am sent by the living Father, myself draw life from the Father, so whoever eats me will draw life from me." Eats me. It's a metaphor, of course, though we do it ritually when we eat the Eucharist. But whoever nourishes themselves on me and my love, well, they'll draw life from me, and I'm drawing life from the Father. "Likewise, I have revealed you to them," this is John 17, "I have revealed you," speaking of God, "to them, and I will continue to do so, so that the love with which you loved me," says to the Father, "will be in them," that love, "and I may be in them." He wants them to experience the communion that he has as man with God. When Jesus loved people, his one desire was that they would come to know God as their Father too. Quoting again John 17, "that the world will realize that it was you, Father, who sent me." What's the point of the world thinking, isn't Jesus a wonderful person, if their image of God is still hopeless? He wants them to see, wait a minute, okay, if you think I'm a nice person, well, okay, that's what you're thinking, but I want you to know that what I'm revealing to you is God. You get me? So he wants to connect them with God, not with him. Through him. Otherwise, and that's the point of the incarnation, is that when we see Jesus, we're not just seeing a loving man. We can meet loving men and women in our life. We're actually having our whole concept of God turned on its head and renewed by Jesus. This is the God who's being revealed in him. All right. He says in John, "that the world will realize that you, Father, sent me, missioned him, and that you've loved them even as you've loved me." See, I want them to know that they're just as loved as I am. And I feel really loved by you, Father, even though he has his agonies and all of that. He wants people to realize, Mary of Magdala and Peter and Judas and everyone else, that they're really, this is what God is. God is simply love. Now that sounds simple to say, and I know you know I'm speaking the truth, but the truth of that takes a long time to enter people's minds still today, 2,000 years later, because our images of God keep thundering back. Because we read the Old Testament as though it was just as good as the New, do you get me? And we infect our ideas that Jesus gave us. It was said to you of old, but I say to you. And we say it was said to you of old, and I say to you. And we put them all in one big potpourri, and we end up with God being vicious, male, Jewish, all the rest of it, and God being a loving, gentle Father. And we've got two heads, and they don't get together. And mostly because we're so insecure, the fear one predominates. And poor Jesus has done all he's done in vain, because we haven't got the message. Oh, did I go too fast then? Yeah, I'll read what I had then. The Catholic Catechism, number 478, quotes Pius the 12th, Haereatis Arquas, which was draw water from the wombs, from the wells of salvation. He wrote that in 1956. I was in the seminary at the time. And the Sacred Heart of Jesus, pierced for by our sins and for our salvation, is quite rightly considered the chief sign and symbol of that love with which the Divine Redeemer continually loves the Eternal Father and all human beings without exception. So devotion to the heart of Jesus, which of course is as old as the Old Testament and New Testament, Old Testament in its symbolic and then the New Testament, so it comes right through. And today it's become a very popular, gentle way of entering into God's love through the symbol of the heart. Oh, it's there. Jesus, so we're moving, we've seen Jesus as a man, we've talked about his love. Now we come to Jesus called the Son of God. I'm still talking about Jesus of Nazareth. So I'll have to come back to this title three times in the course of these weeks. But let's look at it at its simplest level now, Son of God. Son of God was a title for the king. It's another way of saying he's the Messiah. Don't take it too big yet or too deep. Just if he's called Son of God, that means he's the king. He's the Messiah. Here's the text from the Old Testament, which we've done already, but I'll do it again. 2 Samuel, I will be a father to him and he a son to me. Talking about Solomon to David. Your son will be my son. He'll be my son to you. I'll look after him for you. The Psalm 2, number 7, the consecration or psalm for the king. You are my son, today I have begotten you. And that text is quoted in the New Testament, which shows you how they understood it too. In Acts chapter 13, Hebrews chapter 1 and chapter 5, that is actually quoted. So Jesus is the son, the king, the Messiah. Thirdly, Psalm 89, he shall cry to me, you are my father, my God, and the rock of my salvation. I will make him the firstborn, the highest of the kings of the earth. The word son isn't actually used, but father is and son is implied. And this image, Psalm 89, is used of Jesus as the firstborn in the risen life, which is not our topic now, I'll come back to that, in Colossians and in the book of Revelation. So I'm keeping the term Son of God at its simplest level now, meaning Messiah. Here it is, more of it still. Mark chapter 1, the opening words of the Gospel, the beginning of the good news about Jesus the Christ, the Son of God. John, that's what his Gospel's all about. Jesus the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God. They're equivalent terms. Son of God has deeper meanings that we'll come to, but that's what it... Now, John also, when he's summing up at the end, his last words of his Gospel, same kind of theme. These signs are recorded that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, the Messiah, the Son of God, the King, the Son of God. And that believing this, you may have life through him. He's the Messiah. He's the one sent to reveal God to us and to bring us salvation. They were seeking all the more to kill Jesus. This is John chapter 5. Because he was calling God his own Father, they claimed, making himself equal to God. John chapter 5. If you read John's Gospel carefully, you'll notice that every time, without exception, people accuse Jesus of something, the accusation is wrong and is clarified in the next meditation. Because John, in Ephesus or wherever he's writing, most probably Ephesus, is meeting the objections of the Jews through those chapters from 4 right through to 12. It's a polemic, an argument with the Jews who are misunderstanding Jesus. And so this is a misunderstanding. They're saying, look, you're calling God your father, which he did, so you're making yourself equal to God. Look at Jesus' answer. Jesus said to them, very truly I tell you, the Son can do nothing on his own, but only what he sees the Father doing. He's not an equal, an independent God or anything. No, I'm only doing what my Father shows me. For whatever the Father does, the Son does the same. The Father loves the Son and shows him all that he is doing. Jesus felt open to God, and God revealed to him all that he wanted to do, which was love, really. And so he said, what are you doing? What are you accusing me of? I'm only doing what I see my Father doing, and I'm listening to my Father, and I'm obedient to my Father, and I don't do anything independent of him. John chapter 10, they accuse him again, and he says, how can you say that the one whom the Father has sanctified and sent into the world is blaspheming because he says, I am God's Son? They accuse him of saying he's God. He says, no, I'm God's Son. God's Son. What was in the psyche of Jesus? I don't know. I haven't got the evidence to say it, but I'm trying to help you kind of calm a bit and try and look at Jesus of Nazareth really as man, and he's searching for his identity, as we all do, and wondering and pondering and loving and listening, and because he was like us in mind and heart, not just in body. Here, the beautiful parable, now we'll move to Matthew 11:27, when Jesus gives this last of all, of Mark, sorry, first Mark 12, last of all, the owner of the vineyard sent his beloved son. He sent all the prophets, you know, the servants into the vineyard, and they killed them. And if you remember the words that come after that, when this owner of the vineyard in Jesus' parable sends his beloved son, he says, he goes on to say, surely thou listen to my son. Surely thou respect my son. But they don't. They take him, throw him outside the vineyard and kill him. Jesus can see the vultures gathering and they're about to kill him too. And Matthew 11, no one knows the Father except the Son and those to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. No one knows the Father except the Son and those to whom the Son chooses. So Jesus is very conscious of this intimate gift that he's been given to know God, that he really, his mission is to show it, to live it, right through to the end. Still staying with Jesus as God's Son, at the simplest human level, I've just opened up for you 5 points that in which I think they're worth meditating on. Why is Jesus God's Son? One, Jesus receives his being and his life from God. That's what sons do. They get their life from their father. In their understanding, it was only from the father, because they didn't understand the biology of male and female. The male situation is totally obvious and external. The woman's is more secret and hidden, so they didn't know about it. So it was all coming from the sperm of the male. So the total life of the son or the daughter comes from dad, and the mum nurtures it. Well, I draw my life from the father. That's why I'm his son. Two, Jesus receives instructions from God. That's what sons received from their father. The son can do only what he sees the father doing. I come from him, and it was he who sent me. Thirdly, Jesus' one desire is to do his father's will. I always do what pleases my father, he says. I'm quoting from all these quotes are from the New Testament. Fourthly, Jesus hands on the life he's received from his father. That's what sons do. They receive this life and they hand it on to their children. Well, he says, the Father who is the source of life has made the Son the source of life. And finally, Jesus is the living image of God. In other words, if you see, well, to have seen me is to have seen the Father. He's the human expression of God, the incarnation of God. Still on God's Son. I'll just read these without giving the reference. They're all from John, different places in John. The Father knows me and I know the Father. The Father and I are one. Communion of love. The Father is in me and I'm in the Father, says Jesus. I'm in the Father and you are in me and I'm in you. Well, his being in the Father is the same, he's using the same words, and I'm in you. Well, how is Jesus in us? It's a communion of love and all of that. I pray that they will be one as we are one, Father. I want them to be one too, the same way. With me in them and you in me. Beautiful invitation to the whole world to be in love. To welcome Jesus' life is to be adopted as, inverted commas, sons. This is not a gender statement, but you've got to keep the word sons there. Don't change it to children, because you get into a different thing. If you talk about us as children of God, that's a fine thing to say, and we are children of God. But when Paul talks about us being adopted as sons, there's no way of taking it away. You have to keep the word sons there and explain it, because what it's talking about is not being a male or female, but it's talking about us actually having the life of the Son, you know? Whether we're, it's not saying we're children of God, that's true, but this is saying we have the life that the Son has. So we're sons, whether male or female. You have to, poor, you beautiful women have to cope with that thing. We don't have much to cope with, us males, because the language of the Bible is written by men, so it's mainly from that perspective. But we have some. I have to think of myself, if I'm going to read the book of Revelations, as the bride of Christ. And it's true, you know, but in other words, I have to do a mental shift a bit. We don't have to do much. You have to do a lot, but bear with us. But this is really important, that the word son is kept here for the reasons I hope I've been clear in giving you. And Ephesians 1, 3 to 5. God the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ chose us to live through love in his presence, determining that we should become his adopted sons, adopted into the family. Jesus is the one who has this intimacy, and we're like adopted into the family. But we really are sons, we're sharing it, but we're adopted into this relationship that the man Jesus has with his wonderful God. Jesus is called in the New Testament God's only son. And I'll come down to the end first before I read the text. To say that Jesus is the only son is to recognize his unique communion with God, and that we share in this communion by sharing Jesus' life and Jesus' spirit. That's the whole of the Christian life. Living, I live no longer I, but Christ lives in me. So that's what's specific to Christianity, is Jesus. Nothing else, but it's a big thing. And it's sharing his life, adopted into his life. And he's the only one. There's something absolutely unique about this Jesus. But it's not unique separated. It's unique drawing us all into that unique communion. Here are the texts, again all from John's Gospel, some letters. The Word became flesh and lived among us, and we've seen his glory, the glory of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. Again, no one has ever seen God. We've done a lot on that. It's God, the only Son, who is close to the Father's heart, or in the Father's bosom, more accurately, who has made him known. In that very intimate place of love that no one else had ever been in, and they wanted to be in, and they were drawn into it, and they experienced it, thanks to Jesus' love for them and his Spirit in their hearts. John 3, God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, there it is again, so that everyone who believes in him may not perish, but may have eternal life. Those who believe in him are not condemned, but those who do not believe are condemned already, because they have not believed in the name, the person, of the only Son of God. And if we don't recognize Jesus as the incarnation, the human expression of God, we'll find Jesus very attractive, but God still remains totally mysterious and unrevealed, and all our fears and projections of God can come back and sit there quite easily. But if we realize that Jesus is the incarnation of God, any idea of God that comes into our mind that doesn't fit with Jesus, we know is wrong, so we can discard it. And that's what salvation is largely, freeing us from our false theological and religious ideas. This love, I'll do this quickly, this love God showed to us. Every now and then I just mention the disc, you see, that's disc 9 and 10 is just on this topic. So two whole discs are covering what I'm now going to do in 3 minutes. So and this may be a bit hard for you to follow, but I'm just trying to give you an impression. It's all of the wealth of the New Testament about Jesus. And stay with it, and don't think of the risen Christ yet, and don't reflect back on him in the light of your dogmas and everything. Just take Jesus, the man, and see what we can discover about him. Jesus showed us God's love. And he also showed us, which I do in another two whole lectures, and how we can respond to God. So that's, he's revealing to us who God is and who we are really, and showing us how to do it, how to be a human being, how to be a man, how to be a woman, how to be a lover, how to be a prayerful, free, wonderful human being. And here again I'm quoting from my own book here. From a number of points of view, Jesus failed. He himself was killed, and only a generation after his crucifixion, his land was ravaged by war. His worst fears were realized. You remember the time he broke down and wept? Okay, towards the end of his short ministry, his failure bore in upon him, And we find him weeping over the city and undergoing his own personal agony. But the story of Christianity is the story of Jesus' success. Some listened to his teaching and believed him. He had said once, "I've come to bring fire to the earth, and how I wish it were blazing already." He started a fire in people's hearts, and in spite of his own short-term failure to avert the hell that was threatening, he left his contemporaries with what John calls the way, the truth, and the life. The truth that God is our Father. The life of intimacy with God that enables us, as it enabled Jesus, to live life to the full, even amid failure. The way of communion with God that bears fruit in love. The prayer, "The Father, may your kingdom come."